Hello, friends, and welcome to the Caroline Gleick Show. Caroline here, I'm your host. On this podcast, we're going to be exploring a variety of topics, from adventure and activism, climate change messaging, mountaineering, skiing, relationships, and how we can use sport to change the world. All right. I am so excited to sit down and chat with Jess Leahy today. She was my high school English teacher, and when I moved to Utah when I was 15, and in life, sometimes you just know your people. When I met Jess, there was something about her, and I instantly felt like we were kindred spirits. In 2015, Jess wrote The Gift of Failure, a New York Times best-selling book about how parents must let their children fail. Providing a path towards solutions, Leahy lays out a blueprint with targeted advice for handling homework, report cards, social dynamics, and sports. Most importantly, she sets forth a plan to help parents learn to step back and embrace their children's failures. She has a BA in comparative literature and a JD with a concentration on juvenile and educational law, and hosts a successful podcast, hashtag MWriting. Her second book, The Addiction Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence, will be released in April of 2021. And I'm so excited to reconnect with her and talk about failure, addiction, and me as an awkward high school student. So Jess, thank you so much for being here today.
You're so welcome. And I actually have pictures of you from high school, and you weren't awkward at all. You with your dreadlocks, and you were adorable.
I don't believe you somehow. I feel like I was such a late bloomer in life. And that year that I met you, I just moved to Utah from Minnesota, and it was just such a hard transition for me.
Yes. No, yeah. It was... Not only did I meet you, but my husband had worked with your half-brother,
right,
and yeah. Knew your dad. And it was really cool because I sort of got a couple of different lenses on you. And I don't think you're awkward at all. I think you had a really good sense of who you were from very early on. And I think that's what shines through in people when you first get to know them.
I was really like in a rebellious phase when I met you then. And it was, yeah, high school was, I was so awkward, and I had no friends. I felt so weird in high school. I was definitely a late bloomer in life.
Well, it's been really cool being in touch with so many of the kids from your class that I've gotten to watch you guys bloom in all different directions and doing all kinds of amazing things. I have a painting one of your classmates made hanging in my living room. I get letters from, you know, classmates of yours all the time. It's been really an honor and a privilege to be a part of your life going, you know, as you go forward. And, you know, I talk about you in my classroom. I've used the REI video follow through as one of my writing prompts for my writing students. It's been pretty cool.
Likewise for you. And it was really cool to see all the success of your book. So let's talk about your book, The Gift of Failure. Where did the idea for the book come from?
You know, I think it was one of those things where, you know, I was starting to have some concerns about my students' motivation, my students' reliance on, you know, sort of the, my parents will love me more if I get A's. Oh, you know, I will only be worthy if I get A's. And so suddenly, you know, a whole bunch of things kind of came together. And this one student wrote a paper for me where she basically said that, where she was a skier actually. And I talk about this in the book that she told me that she was so focused on grades and points and scores that learning had become beside the point for her. And she also, this isn't in the book, but she raced downhill. And she talked about the fact that her times were actually getting slower, not faster, because she was holding on so tight to technical perfection that she couldn't ever just let it ride. And, you know, that was really an interesting metaphor for me. And I was also just really angry because this was a kid who loved to learn. And now she's telling me it's like not important to her anymore. And so I got really upset and with her parents, of course, and I was on this horribly high horse about the whole thing. And then I realized I was doing the same thing to my own kids. And that's, you know, I went home and I realized that my own kid who was nine, my younger son was nine, and he couldn't tie his own shoes. And that's when I realized I was parenting him into a state of helplessness as well. And I had to sort of figure out the research behind that and figure out how to do better as a teacher and as a parent. Because helplessness, making kids helpless happens at schools and it happens at home.
Yeah. I mean, your book has really, just that concept of sort of owning our failures and being allowed to fail has really, I mean, it's so difficult to grasp at first because it's so unnatural to everything we're taught in society. And yeah, it's really revolutionized a lot of my thinking. So what else did you see in society that made you feel like you needed to write the book?
Well, at about the same time that I was looking looking at sort of how the overparenting thing was not only messing with kids' motivation, it was really also messing with their ability to learn, because there was some research that had just come out that showed that kids who have parents who were constantly telling them like, okay, first do this, next do this, next do this, and didn't really give their kids a chance to figure things out for themselves, that those kids are less comfortable with frustration. And when you're less comfortable with frustration, you can't really benefit from some of the more powerful teaching tools that there are. And one of them is this thing called desirable difficulties. And my dogs might just start barking. We'll see what happens because there's a squirrel outside the window. When desirable difficulties are this really powerful tool that helps me get a kid past just cramming stuff into their short-term memory. It allows me to sort of get them to a point where they're having to parse information on their own. And when they do that, it bypasses short-term memory and it gets sort of encoded into your long-term memory. And so it's this incredible learning tool. And if by overparenting our kids and being what's called highly directive with our kids, we're actually making it so that they're less able to learn when they get into school and they're more likely to get frustrated and give up. So what that was happening. And then Carol Dweck's book, Mindset, came out, and Mindset changed the way I think about my own ability to learn. When I was in seventh grade, I got the message very clearly from my teachers that I wasn't good at math. And that became my identity. I'm really good at all these things, but math is not one of them. And that became destiny. Sort of that label became destiny for me. And I got so angry about it after I read the book Mindset, which is a brilliant book, that I went back in my 40s and retook Algebra 1 again with my kid and with my own students, because I was just mad that one teacher could say, you're not good at math. And that became who I thought I was. And I stayed away from math for my entire college and career. It was, so anyway, I retook math and it turns out I'm not bad at math. I'm perfectly good at math. It's just that math gets hard for everyone eventually. But my response to it getting hard was to say, oh, well, that's it. I'm just not good at it, which is crap, which is not true.
And do you think that teacher's comment had anything to do with your gender?
I mean, yes, there's probably, but it also just happened that year math did get difficult for me and I hit a roadblock. And one of the things that we know, well, math obviously gets difficult for everyone at some point, even people who are incredible geniuses at math. But how you deal with it when it gets hard for you is going to spell whether or not, is going to dictate whether or not you're actually successful in the end. Because if math gets hard for me and I say, well, that's it, I stink, I can't do math, and I give up, well, of course, I'm never going to become good at math. But if I say, well, that's interesting, I can't do this yet, that's going to make it so that I have what's called a growth mindset. And I believe that the harder I try at this thing, the more likely I am to become successful at it. And, lots of things get hard, but that doesn't mean we're not good at them. It just means that we don't know how to do them yet, or we're not good at them yet. And, given what you do, you didn't jump on your first pair of skis and barrel down the mountain. And, that's not how things work. And I think we lose sight of that when we're dealing with kids. We want kids to just get it and we don't want them to get frustrated.
Well, I think people also, I think it's hard for people to see all the years of struggling that goes, like, people just see this image on Instagram and they just assume like I found myself on the summit of Everest, but it's hard to convey all those years of those baby steps from just like getting my first pair of powder skis, and all those hundreds of hours that I spent out there freezing my toes off and my fingers off. And yeah, it's really hard to convey that sometimes. And people just want that instant gratification. And they think that you just like teleported up there.
Right. So which is why it's so important to talk about that stuff. Like with students, you know, with my students all the time, when they say, I don't like editing, I'm like, well, let me show you, I don't like editing either, but here's sort of how my career went. And here's how, when Gift of Failure, when I first handed in the first draft of Gift of Failure, it was terrible. And I had to learn how to write a book. It's not that I like just knew how to write a book all of a sudden. It was horrible. And then my editor worked with me and then it wasn't horrible. And I think adults don't really want kids to see them as anything other than perfect. And so they tend to keep that growth from their kids. But then if your kids see you struggle with something and then you're good at it in the end, they're like, wow, you know, my mom or dad or whoever that adult is worked really hard to get good at that. And that's how that stuff works.
Well, I think adults are also uncomfortable showing other adults or even showing themselves as struggling because of all these societal expectations and whatnot. So what are some ways from some tools from the book that people can deal with that sort of frustration and those plateaus that come with learning?
Well, whether it's dealing with your own or dealing with someone else's, like with my kids, I have to keep in my head all the time this sort of mantra of we have to value the process over the end product. Like, over and over and over again, I have to think to myself, okay, do I want to do this for the kid so that it's perfect right now? Or do I want my kid to be the kind of person who can do it himself a month from now or 6 months from now? And same thing with for myself. You know, it would be so much easier for me to say, go figure out this whole website thing or pay someone to do this website thing and then just give it back to me when it's done. But then I don't know how to run my own website. So, you know, there's that value in learning something new that we have to keep at the forefront. So value the process over the product and try to think more long-term and less about the short-term. And it's one of the reasons I love the documentary Follow Through so much is that, and why I use it with my students. You know, I say to them after we watch it, look, Caroline didn't say, I want to ski these routes and I'm just going to go do it. No. She had to go, you know, get better at mountaineering. She had to do the avalanche training. She had to do all this other, and get fit. She had to do all these. So what we do is I help the kids come up with like a big goal that they want, like their dream goal. And then I say, okay, that's great. You can do that. But what are you going to have to do first? And usually for them, it starts with stay sober because, you know, we're in a rehab. But then after that, like, you know, who are you going to seek out to help mentor you in that area? Who, you know, how are you going to learn how to do all these things you're going to have to know how to do in order to be a rap star, which is what unfortunately half of them want to do, that's what their goal is. But whatever that big goal is, you have to come up with those smaller goals to get there. And that requires long-term vision.
Yeah. It's a great analogy. I mean, that even now, just looking back at that project, it's like, sometimes I feel like I have this weird out of body experience. Cause I'm like, I'm not that person. Like, I don't know how I did that, but I also really miss having that project because it was nice to have that. It was like probably 10 or 15 years of work that went into getting to the point where I could even look at some of those lines and see that they were fathomable. I was wondering, I've been thinking about this also in my relationship with my partner, because a lot of these things, these patterns from parent to child are also in our relationships with our significant others. So I was wondering if you're with your relationship with your partner, Tim, if there's anything that you've, any of these processes, or if you are conscious of how you are dealing with your relationship with him as well.
Fairly sure I do the stuff right and everyone else does the stuff wrong. Uh-huh. Whether that's like, I don't know, unloading the dishwasher or, you know, fixing the toilet or whatever the thing is. And, you know, I have a very capable husband. He's a physician. He's a medical ethicist. He's a very smart human being. And every once in a while, I have to stop and say, I am underestimating the competence of these people around me, whether that's my kid or my husband. And, you know, I think that a lot of that comes from my sort of, I like things the way I like them. And I like to be independent. I like to have control. And I think ceding control has been has been one of the hardest things. And I think the second thing that I have to work on every single day is remembering that we're a team, and that, is it more important for me to be right in this moment, or is it more important for us to continue to be a team and to work toward the same goal together? And boy, I really like being right in the moment. But what I really, really want for the long term is to keep my relationship intact. And so that's, I have to think about that a lot.
Yeah, what really speaks to me and what I've been trying to work on in my relationship is that art of letting go and like letting him learn, like do the things his way and try not to micromanage. I mean, that's such a challenge with all relationships, I think, is letting go. But I specifically remember when I first met my partner, and he came from more of a triathlon background, so he didn't have as much of the backcountry and avalanche skills as I did. And instead of trying to micromanage him, I'm like, you go take an avalanche course on your own and learn with someone else, because I think it will be better that way. And then you come back to me after you've taken your Avi 2 class, and then we'll go out and ski these things together. But I didn't really want to be the one trying to teach him, because I just felt like it could really go wrong, or it could mess up our relationship. So that was a good way of letting go. But then there's so many little things like the dishwasher, or like working on a paint project where I'm like, are you really taping like that?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's so hard to let go of little things.
Yeah. I think we have in our house, we have some fairly delineated responsibilities in the house. When I started traveling more for work and doing a lot of speaking, Tim finally learned how to cook, which was great. So good for him, and so good for him and our kids, and, you know, them figuring out cooking together. But now when I'm home, you know, we just sort of agree that only one of us cooks at a time, because if there are two of us in the kitchen, it gets a little conflicted. It's just easier. You know, I respect him and he respects me, but it's sort of best if we do our own thing. And what's really interesting is he's also a writer, and we do read each other's stuff. But we write about slightly different things, which is great. I don't think we could work together, except at the moment with everyone being at home because of COVID, we are sort of working together, but he lives in the basement for the most part right now. So.
So with the whole COVID pandemic going on, I was curious, because now I feel like family dynamics and all these relationships are really magnified. So what are some tips or lessons from your book that people could apply to their family dynamics in these challenging times of being in such close quarters?
Yeah, I think what's been really interesting lately is that people find themselves feeling really stressed out, but in the end, having a little bit more time together than they sort of planned on. And so there are these really great opportunities to finally have the time to teach people how to do stuff for themselves, especially. And also, we right now, if one person is the person who does all the cleaning, you're just going to go bonkers. Because I don't know what it's like in most people's houses, but suddenly I have two young men and my husband and myself, and that's a lot of dishes and a lot of laundry. And I'm just not used to the amount of cleaning that has to happen these days. So we've all had to pitch in. And that's been, I think, really good for all of us. And we're also learning how to be better family members, I think, how to respect each other's space. Because, you know, even if you live in a really, really big house, it gets really close when you're on top of each other all the time.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because the past few years, my schedule has also involved a lot of travel. And as hard as some of the travel can be, you know, when you're staying at a different hotel room every night or going from city to city, there's also this beauty of coming home and missing home. And so that's been a huge adjustment for me, is that all of a sudden we don't have that separation where we really miss each other. It's a really weird adjustment.
Well, and I love the travel. I love my speaking career. It's also, you know, frankly, I lost, you know, about 60% of my annual income this year when everything was canceled. So it's been really challenging. It's also sort of turned much of my understanding of who I am and what I do upside down, because I just finished a book project. I'm just starting to research a new one, and I don't have a very clear deadline for things right now, and I tend to work best under a deadline. So it's been a real shift for me to be quieter and to be more patient and to find space for myself and to create my own deadlines.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I also feel like my injury, because I tore my ACL last year about 7 weeks before leaving for Everest. And then I had surgery when I got home. And so I feel like my injury sort of prepared me well for this. Because with injuries, you're just dealing with this long timeline before you can do what you want to do again. And it's so interesting how you just question who you are. And you go through these periods where you feel so lost and like this ego that you've built up is just demolished. But what I've been relishing right now is having this opportunity to reconnect with these parts of myself that I have to not abandon, but put in the back when I'm super focused on a mountaineering project or another project. And so it's been kind of nice to like revisit my inner pioneer woman who's doing all these home repairs and all these projects. And it's fun to meet all these my quarantine alter egos.
Yeah. I'm usually gone. So we moved last year from New Hampshire to Vermont and we're in the woods now. And so there isn't a lot of great garden space, but in our old home in New Hampshire, I had really turned it into a very small farm. I mean, I'd worked so hard for a decade to really get that soil amended and I was growing a lot of our food. It was so great. And then we moved and now I've not really had the opportunity to do that at our new property. And I've always said, because I travel during the spring and during the fall, I just haven't gotten to that yet. But well, now I'm getting to it. I just built some raised beds the other day and I'm scavenging, for mulch in the woods. And it's been really, really great to have that time out in the woods by myself. It's been really good for me. I think that's really what's been saving my sanity. We actually got a tiny bit of snow today here in Vermont and I'm really ready for winter to be over because being outside is what's going to save me during this time.
Yeah, I love following you on Twitter and seeing your wildlife camera.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, I'm hoping to figure out where the fox kits are. We have a family of foxes. We have a bobcat. We have, yesterday, just as we were eating dinner together, I saw something out of the corner of my eye and I looked out the window and there was a barred owl looking, standing on our front porch, looking in the kitchen window. It was pretty cool. It was very, very cool.
That's really cool. I've been curious because I met you, way back when in 2002. And so I wanted to hear a little bit more about your journey to getting to where you are now.
Mm-hmm.
And what's up? Yeah.
Well, it's funny that you say that thing about how all people see is suddenly you're on the top of Everest. Well, for me, all people saw was suddenly I had this best-selling book. I had this viral article and this best-selling book. But what most people don't realize is I've been writing the entire time. I wrote when I was little. I was editor-in-chief of my school paper. I wrote in college. I wrote for the Little King's English newsletter in Salt Lake City. I was a speechwriter for the governor of Utah for a little while I was teaching you guys, actually. And so I was doing that part-time and teaching you part-time. And so I've always written. And then, so my editor at the New York Times, whenever she hears me say, I got so lucky with this article that went viral and a book came out of it, she says, you're not really allowed to say that because yeah, sure, there may have been some luck involved, but if that opportunity had come your way and you didn't have all that work behind it, you wouldn't have been ready to sort of grab that opportunity. So I had been writing the entire time and I had actually written a book that didn't sell, that I was able to sell in pieces as essays and stuff like that. And then after I finished that and it didn't sell, I was like, I just don't know what I'm going to write about. And Tim said, when you're talking about teaching, that's when you really light up. And so maybe you should write about that. And so a lot of teachers blog because it's just a great place to, when Blogger first started, I started just blogging about whatever it was I was doing in my classroom. And suddenly that sort of got a bigger and bigger audience. At first it was like my friend and my mother were the only people reading that. And then it sort of caught on in education circles. And then I started writing for a couple of other sort of bigger blogs. And then I wrote some stuff for The Atlantic and The New York Times. And then off it went. And I got to write a column for The New York Times for 3 years called The Parent Teacher Conference. And now I pretty much write mostly for The Washington Post and a couple of other outfits. And I'm just starting research on my third book.
That is awesome. That's, I didn't know that you were a speechwriter. Uh-huh. Which governor? Matheson?
No. So when Leavitt was elected for his third term, I wrote his inaugural address for that third term. And I was writing it while I was teaching you guys. So I would teach and then I would go work on that stuff. And in the afternoons. Because actually when I was teaching you guys, I was... I had young kids and so did my friend Margaret. And so we took each other's kids. So she would take my kids in the morning while I taught you guys. They allowed me to sort of line up my classes so that I taught one right after the other and so that I could leave early. And then I would go take care of her kids and then go home in the evening. And so it was this incredible balancing act between school and my son at the time, Ben, who was born in Salt Lake City, and writing for the governor.
It was really, really fun. Yeah, I like writing. Do you have any tips for political speech writing?
I hadn't done any of it. This was a real trial by fire for me and learning. I just read every speech he had ever given that I could get my hands on so that I could get into someone else's voice and get into someone else's politics, get into someone else's voice. And the thing I love so much about writing is finding the exact right word to not only convey the meaning, the denotation, the dictionary definition of that word, but also the connotation, the bigger sort of bigger picture meaning of that word within the context of our culture. And it was really, he was a Republican, I'm a Democrat. It was really interesting to have to write not only in someone else's voice, but in someone else's politics. It was a really fun challenge for me. I loved it.
Yeah, speech writing, I love writing speeches personally because it's so different than writing an academic paper or even for a blog or for Instagram because the spoken part of it. And so what other, how else does it differ, do you think, from writing a book?
Oh, when I wrote Gift of Failure and then I got to do the audiobook for it, I found out that there are some very similar aspects because when I wrote that speech for Governor Leavitt, for then Governor Leavitt, there was one line I really, really liked. And no matter how many times he rehearsed it, he just couldn't say it. It just wasn't coming out the right way. So we had to ditch that entire line and get it off the teleprompter and blah, blah, blah. And the same thing happened to me when I was reading my audiobook. There was just this one line I couldn't get through. So what I try to do with everything that I write is to read it out loud, literally out loud when no one's in the house, because that allows me to not only find the errors that I wouldn't have found otherwise, but to know whether or not I'm just going to be able to say those things. And since I do so much speaking, that's become a real part of my process, is to make sure I'm really giving those speeches as I'm writing them.
It is such a good tip. I found so many grammatical errors or typos, or sometimes you repeat the same word twice. That is such
a
great
tip. The Gift of Failure had been through my agent editing it, my editor editing it, copy edit. It was in its final stages, and we found 17 typos or errors in the book when I read the audio version. So, you know, there's always one more error to find, is what I've learned from that.
That's fascinating. So on your speaking tours, what topics do you speak about?
So it really depends. If I'm talking, I'm in the middle of a segue right now into sort of this new content. But for Gift of Failure stuff, what I'll often do is, for example, if I'm going to a school, I'll talk to the students during the day about sort of taking ownership of their learning and motivating them and talking to them a little bit about growth mindset and stuff like that. And then I'll talk to the teachers and do professional development about learning in the brain, how kids learn best, that kind of stuff, what various tools and tricks that work. And then in the evening, I talk to the parents. And the fun part of that for me is I'll give the kids my email address while I'm talking to them. And I say, look, I'm going to talk to your parents in like 4 hours. So you have 4 hours to send me emails about what it is you want me to tell your parents tonight. And the emails I get are amazing. It's really, really fun. And now I'm out there also talking about substance abuse prevention, what really works for substance abuse prevention, what education programs work for substance abuse prevention. It's really fun. I also get to do some sort of in-between stuff where I talk about what kids for whom failing is not like this little thing. I get to talk now about kids who are at really high risk of catastrophic failure. And I talk a lot about teaching kids who are motivationally challenged, because you know, what I had to get good at in the rehab was, if you can picture, you know, kids really stoked to be in a rehab, number one, but then you have to tell them that not only are they in rehab and they have to follow all these rules that they don't want to follow and all that stuff, they also have to go to school in rehab. So suddenly, and some of the biggest risk factors for substance abuse are early learning issues. I had a lot of kids with dyslexia, ADHD, and, you know, all of these learning issues that were never dealt with when they were little. So I'll now have a classroom of kids who are 16, 17, 18, but whose reading level is still in elementary school, and who feel, you know, they feel like they are stupid. They've been told they're stupid and they have no expectations for themselves. And, you know, getting those kids motivated to read a book, you know, that's a huge win for me. And I had to really change my, after having taught, you know, in plenty of schools where kids are already pretty motivated to learn, I had to really rethink what a successful day of teaching meant for me. And I have to say, I love teaching kids who are, you know, raring to go and super excited to learn, but there's something really fun about convincing kids who don't think of themselves as smart or as good learners that they really are good learners, and that they can learn, and that they are smart. That's the big win for me these days.
That's really cool.
Really, yeah. Really fun.
I was curious if you could tell me more about your book, your new book that's coming out in 2021. Yeah. Is that related to what you just talked about with your experiences?
So I am, you know, after Gift of Failure did well and, you know, like hit the New York Times bestseller list and it sold really well, there's that fear of, am I gonna, you know, what if the next thing doesn't do well? Or how am I ever gonna top this? Or, you know, people expect me to write, you know, and I knew I didn't want to write like Gift of Failure Part 2, you know, more Gift of Failure. That's definitely wasn't something I wanted to do. So my agent was great and really supportive, and she listened to me pitch a whole bunch of really bad ideas just because I needed to just think about what the next thing was going to be. And it really just presented itself through, I pitched maybe 10 different crappy ideas to my agent, but those 10 crappy ideas coalesced to become this one book that was about what really works to prevent substance abuse in kids. And, you know, as someone who, I'm a recovering alcoholic myself, and I am raising two kids who are genetically predisposed to substance abuse. And I come from a long family line of people who, you know, alcoholics and addicts. And so this was essentially Gift of Failure and this new book, The Addiction Inoculation, were both books that I needed as a teacher and a parent that didn't exist out there. So both of them are kind of memoir-y, but both of them are also really rooted in the research. So, and that's what's really fun for me. I love researching. I love it, love it, love it. So I spent, from the time I had the idea about what I would write, it was a year before my agent sent off the proposal for The Addiction Inoculation. And then I took another year to write it. And we first talked about it coming out this fall, but trying to get a book, any publicity for a book during an election cycle, during the election season, is just a nightmare. So we pushed it to, April of 2021, which is fine with me.
How much do you draw on your own experience then in your own process of dealing with your own addiction versus
a lot. Yeah. Well, and this book was harder to write for me because it's really personal. You know, there's stuff in there. My husband hasn't even read it yet.
Really?
It's it's really, really personal. The people who had substance abuse issues as kids who are now adults that let me use their names in this book. One of them was a classmate of yours, and she let me use her story as sort of how her substance abuse started, where it took her, and how she's sort of recovered from that. Another chapter is shaped around a friend of my son's who's now getting a degree in psychology and wants to open his own substance abuse facility for teens when he's done. I'm so grateful for those people who are willing to be that frank, and from my perspective, I couldn't ask them to do that if I wasn't willing to go there too. And that's so frightening because I know my husband's going to read this book and find out new things. And my kids are going to read this book and find out new things. And that's really scary. But again, there's a great quote that I love from this book about memoir by Abigail Thomas. And she says, as far as memoir is concerned, essentially, the message is to be honest or don't bother. Tell the truth or don't bother. Really, where memoir is concerned, you know, if you're not telling the truth, people are not going to go along with you for the ride.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard to talk about that stuff. I think I just barely started talking about my own battles with substance abuse when I went to rehab when I was 13. And frankly, like the years from, I feel like I really lost myself at the beginning of high school, and then like high school until my early 20s, I'm not really proud of the person that I was. And so it's really hard for me. I mean, I learned a lot, but I made a lot of decisions that I'm not proud of. Like there's a part of me that wants to just forget about that time and never talk about it, like bury that so deep away. But there is a huge power in sharing that vulnerability.
Yeah. I can tell you that every single time I get up on stage and talk about my own substance abuse, I get emails and thank yous. And I get so many notes from people saying, even, you know, people who are saying things like, you know, I think I might, but I'm not sure. I think I might have a problem, but I'm not sure. And, you know, now that I have almost 7 years of recovery, it gets easier every time you talk about it, every single time. And, you know, you know this better than most people, is that it's the secrets that keep you sick. And so I hate secrets. And that's that was a big part of the book too, that, you know, growing up, I wasn't allowed to talk about the possibility that the people around me had problems. That was like, we were supposed to ignore that and pretend like that didn't exist. And that makes me so angry that I think it's one of the reasons that I'm so forthright about that sort of stuff. And then another thing happens, you know, when you have kids that, you know, genetic risk is about 50% of the puzzle there in terms of, you know, predicting who's going to have issues with substances. And I can't afford to not talk about it. In fact, my younger son had to write a paper for a human biology class. And he said, he came home and he said, his teacher said, "How often do you talk about drugs and alcohol in your house?" And my son said, he looked at him and he kind of just rolled his eyes. He's like, "We don't talk about much else in my house because my mom's writing a book about it." So, you know, I think for them, it has to be out there, because if it's not, then I'm going to lose them. I'm going to lose them to the same, you know, mistakes I made.
Well, and you have such a powerful role to play as someone who's destigmatizing talking about substance abuse and mental health in general, because societally, I feel like there's still a huge stigma about talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, it's really interesting because I think so many of the same factors that draw people to mountain sports too make them very susceptible to addiction. And I see so many people on that fine line between just like, you know, brilliance and destruction, where they have so much energy and they just want to take so many risks. And if they don't have the right outlet, it can go dark so easily.
Yeah, absolutely.
What other things from your book can you tell me and can we learn? Give us your secrets.
So, you know, the funny thing is, There's so much going on in education right now that is really makes me really, really hopeful, because the, you know, the Cliff Notes version of the addiction inoculation is that it's, you know, we have kids have a certain amount of risk, and the more risk factors that kids have, the more protections we're going to have to heap on them. So, and risk factors for kids include, you know, a lot of the same things that are these things called adverse childhood experiences. And there's a wonderful, incredible book by Nadine Burke Harris called The Deepest Well. And she's the Surgeon General of California. And she writes about adverse childhood experiences and the impact they have on children's health. And it turns out that the more adverse childhood experiences you have, the higher your risk for all kinds of negative consequences as an adult, whether that's heart attack, stroke, you know, eating disorders, you know, substance abuse. So obviously early intervention for all of, for all the trauma that kids are dealing with. Lots of people talk about risk for addiction as 50% genetics, and then, but genetics can include things like personality type and your tolerance for risk, or your, the amount of dopamine you have sort of at baseline, that kind of stuff. And then the, that's sort of the bullet in the chamber. And then the trigger is trauma. So for so many kids, they go through lots and lots of stuff, adverse childhood experiences. They're, you know, they may not, or they may have genetic predisposition, but they may not ever have really bad childhood trauma that sort of pulls the trigger for them, and they may be fine. So those adverse childhood experiences that include, you know, like neglect and violence in the home and addiction in the home and all that kind of stuff. And then on top of that, you have things like early academic failure. That's a biggie. Early, if a child is aggressive as a child, that's another risk factor for substance abuse. You know, adoption is a risk factor for substance abuse. If your parents get, you know, they're on varying levels, and the important thing I wanted to do in this book was not attach any shame or guilt to any of those things, but to say, look, it's not that it's anyone's fault, but it is a risk factor. So if it is a risk factor and your child has this going on in their life, then let's heap as many of these protective factors on as possible. And protective factors obviously are those early interventions. It's mindfulness practices. It's obviously getting the interventions for their learning issues and their social emotional issues. But then the reason I say I'm so optimistic is that increasingly social emotional learning programs are such an important part of schools, in schools now. So all, and it turns out that the best substance abuse prevention programs in schools are really well-rounded SEL or social emotional learning programs. They're actually the same. So, you know, if you're just going to start talking about drugs and alcohol and in middle school and like bring in someone to say, you know, oh, I took, you know, I started drinking and my life went down the toilet, that, and number one, you're waiting too late. Substance abuse prevention has to start in elementary school in the form of good social emotional learning and refusal skills and things like that, problem solving and negotiation and empathy. But yeah, social, in the end, it looks like social emotional learning programs, really good ones, evidence-based programs, are the best substance abuse prevention programs.
So are there programs that adults can sign up for of that? Because I feel like that's been one of the hardest things. I feel like I've only begun to scratch the surface of that in my late 20s and early 30s. And I'm like, how could people not have taught me this in school? This is the most important thing. I think, I mean, obviously American literature is very important, but I really could have benefited from some of that mindfulness and the emotional intelligence.
Right. Well, and some of that, you know, and some of the ways that this dovetails with the gift of failure stuff is in Gift of Failure, I talk about the fact that some of the most important bullying prevention that we do with kids is when they're super little and you've got two kids in the sandbox and one kid throws sand at the other kid. And we tend to rush in and pull those kids apart and like go separate directions, because that's what makes us good parents, right? Avoiding any sort of conflict and avoiding any sort of frustration or pain. But keeping those kids in the sandbox together and letting them communicate with each other about, you can't treat me that way, and then letting the kid who threw the sand see the look on the kid's face who has been hurt. Those are the social signals that help kids learn empathy and perspective taking. So if we remove those kids from each other and we don't let them see each other's faces and don't let them, you know, learn to self-advocate or learn what it looks like when you've hurt someone, then you end up with a kid who in like seventh grade doesn't understand social boundaries, doesn't understand social cues. And at that point, if you've got a kid who becomes a bully in like seventh or eighth grade, it's, and you want to just think of him as a bad kid, but he's not a bad kid. He's a kid who didn't learn appropriate social cues when he was really, really little. So it's this thing that has to start so early. And yes, there are remedial ways to learn this. And there's, you know, all the way, going all the way down the spectrum, there's a wonderful book. I'll think of the name in a minute and I'll look it up. But there's a book called The Journal of Best Practices. And the guy who wrote that book realized as an adult that he was on the autism spectrum. And he just had never really understood social cues because it had never been a part of his wheelhouse. And so he decided to start teaching himself by writing them down and having his wife help him understand what he was not understanding about what she needed and wanted. So really it all came down to communication with his partner and saying, help me understand better what it is you're trying to tell me that I'm not understanding. And it's a really sweet book. I'm looking up the author right now.
Oh, I'm excited to check that out. I feel like my partner, Rob, is really good at that. He's a realtor and he's a real people person. And sometimes I'm just so literal. I have a hard time with the those sorts of things. So
right. It's called the Journal of Best Practices, a memoir of marriage, Asperger syndrome, and one man's quest to be a better husband by David Finch. And it's not, this is not like a book for a person who may feel like they're on the autism spectrum. It's a really sweet book about realizing when you're simply not understanding someone else's cues and how to throw yourself into getting better at it because you want this relationship to work. And it's very funny. It's very, very funny.
I will link to that in the show notes. I'm really excited to check that out. Have you had any bullies or naysayers as you've gone along the course of your career?
Yeah. And you know, some of it has come from, some of it has come from my simply wanting to be the best possible teacher, be the best possible writer. And some of it has come from, you know, once you have any sort of success at all, you know, there are people who would like to see you fail or want to make room on the pedestal or do that thing, you know, when you put crabs in a bucket and the crabs will pull the other crabs down, that kind of thing. But the nice thing these days about, for example, social media is the ability to block that. And, you know, I got misquoted once and I had a whole group of people come after me, really, really angry. And there was no explaining at that point. No one was really interested in listening. So, you know, blocking became a really important part of my sanity. Realizing that there are just people who don't have my best interest in heart and that are not worth the energy it would require to deal with that person. So, and I think some of that comes from, there's this joke among writers, you know, especially when you write online, don't read the comments. And when I first started writing, especially at the New York Times, actually, the comment section in Motherload, which was the blog that I wrote for at the New York Times, had moderated comments. And so it was actually usually a pretty nice place to be. And because it was an advice column, I would have to read the comments, but I learned really early on not to read the comments pretty much anywhere else because all that was going to do was be destructive. And, you know, you tend to remember the one really mean, horrible comment and not remember the 99, you know, very supportive, wonderful things that people have said.
It's so hard for me to do that. I guess I just struggle sometimes because I feel like is there any hope for the bullies by showing them the pain? You know, like, can we stay in the sand? Are there ones that are worth exerting the energy, or is it always just a block and ignore situation?
You know, I have to say, there's a huge if you haven't read Lindy West's essay on confronting her troll, it's really worth doing. Lindy has left Twitter simply because she found it to be overwhelming. She couldn't block out all that noise. And that was, you know, really sad for me because I thought Lindy West was, I happen to love Twitter. I followed 12,000 teachers mostly on Twitter. So it's a really positive, generally speaking, place for me. But I also am really quick to block if I need to. But Lindy West's essay was so important because she got to actually talk to the person who was bullying her and trolling her. And it turns out it was all about him. It had nothing to do with her. And that's really important for me to remember.
That was when I was dealing with my really gnarly cyber stalking case. I listened to that and I almost want to put my guy on my podcast because I thought it was such an interesting podcast to hear her talk, but I just don't, it could go so wrong too.
Yeah, it really could. In many ways, he was really brave to put himself in the position to discuss it. I mean, it's shocking to me that he did it, especially because when it came down to it, it was all about his insecurity and his... He was so upset that a woman was willing, a fat woman was willing to talk about being fat and talk about being vulnerable. And it made him angry that she could somehow do that and he couldn't.
And isn't he the one he made up an account of her dead father to troll her? It was so disturbing. And I'm surprised that she was able to have that conversation and stay so calm because I would be livid. I would not be able to keep my cool.
Yeah, I would definitely, it would overwhelm me pretty quickly. I probably would have been an emotional mess. The times when people have really come after me, there was one person who really came after me early on and I really let it bother me. I cried. It was horrible. But someone gave me the advice back when that was happening to punch up, always punch above your weight class. And that person who wanted to hurt my feelings was below my weight class. That person, it was best to just walk away from that person and ignore that person because that would not be punching up. That would be punching down. And that's been a really good bit of advice for me.
Okay. That's great. I'm still working on this is something I ask all my guests is how they deal with that because most of the people that I interview have had some experience with bullies and naysayers. And it's hard for me just not to internalize those things and just not that they creep into my psyche at the most inopportune moments.
Yeah.
And it's just,
I have to say, I've been really, really fortunate. I've had very few, incidents where people have come after me personally. And in general, I thought that, you know, the writing world is there's so many people wanting to make a living as writers. There's so many parenting writers out there. There's so many education writers out there, but I have found nothing. Almost 99% of the people I come in contact with are supportive and wonderful. And those are the people I spend my energy on.
Yeah, that's great advice.
And a lot of that comes out of my working really hard. When I first started writing, there were a couple of writers who worked to pull me up. And so I try to channel those people and do the same for the people who are coming up now.
I love that. That's a great way to find that healing and... Yeah, I love that. I wanted to get an update on the boys. How are your children?
My children. So that little boy who you guys used to push up and down the hall in the wheelie chair, he's now 21. Whoa. He'll be 22 in December. Yeah, he's in college. He's studying math and economics and loves it. And
that's wild. And he can drink. Yeah. I mean,
I know. Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Wild. So that was,
and I know. And that's been a whole other world for me too. Like, you know, he's 21 now. This is his life to lead. And that's been, but it's also, he's home right now, obviously because of the COVID stuff. So that's been really lovely. And Finn is 16 now and he's in high school and adjusting to, you know, he had to move away from his friends when we moved to Vermont. And so it's been, you know, an adjustment and now school is online and that's interesting too. But we live out in the woods and they spend a fair amount of time out in the woods. So they seem to like it. They're doing great. They're good kids.
That's so cool. You've done an amazing job. They seem like great, great kids.
I think they're pretty good. And it's really fun watching them you know, become who they are. You know, the person who was, quote, not good at math in middle school has somehow raised a kid who just loves math, just loves it and finds it beautiful and eloquent. And my other kid who, and Finn, you know, is producing digital music. And I don't even know, and teaching himself how to do it based on like YouTube videos. And it's just amazing to me watch them find the thing that really moves them and then just watch them go with it. It's amazing to me.
It's really cool. Well, we'll have to catch up another time and talk about parenting and motherhood, because I feel like down the road, if we have a child, I will have a whole bunch of questions about parenting and career and all those things. So we'll have to catch up again about that. But I wanted to finish by asking you a few rapid fire questions that I ask every
Sure.
guest. First one, favorite TV show?
West Wing.
Favorite book?
Oh, see, it could that's be a too book hard.
Okay, then maybe just a book you're reading now, something current that's inspired you.
I will tell you right now that, because I have favorite books to teach, favorite books to read, but one of the things that's been helping me lately is I reread books when I need comfort, when I have a lot of anxiety, and this whole COVID thing is just giving me a lot of anxiety. And so I've gone back to David Sedaris's Calypso that I must have listened to now 50 times, and Stephen King's On Writing. These books that I know almost by heart, something about them just calms me. I can feel my anxiety and my blood pressure go down when I re-listen to these books that I love so much in the author's voice. So I'd have to give David Sedaris's Calypso or Stephen King's On Writing as two of my very favorites.
Favorite color?
Green.
Favorite food?
Vietnamese, the rice bowls, rice noodles with the fried spring roll and mint and the Nook Chom sauce. That's my very, very favorite dish.
I had that last night for dinner. And oh, I was like, gosh, this is the perfect meal. Yeah. That is something I crave.
And the lettuce and all the good vegetables at the bottom. Yeah.
The mint and all this different things. Those are so good. It's weird. It's called a bun. I think they call it
So the bun, the noodles that are, it is, there's a bunch of different kinds, but the bun noodles are a very specific type of the rice noodles, but it's so good.
It's like heaven. It's just so, that's awesome. I love that. Okay. Morning person or night owl?
Definitely not a morning person. I actually wake up, I sleep in and I go to bed pretty early, but I guess if I had to pick between the two, I'd say night owl.
Wait, so what's sleeping in for you?
Oh, you'd be surprised. I sleep about 12 hours and 10 to 12 hours a night, actually. Yeah. I usually don't roll out of bed until 8:30. And, we go to sleep. Usually we're in bed by 10.
Okay. I can totally relate. I'm the same way lately. I've been getting out of bed at 9 a.m.
Yeah. No, we have a pre-bed ritual. We actually, when we moved to Vermont, we had been saving up for this for a long time. We put a sauna in our house downstairs. And so we sauna every single night before bed, and then just sort of rinse off in the shower and go straight to bed. And it's, you're all warm and sleepy. It's really great.
We have a hot tub and we do that before bed. Nice. And it's nice. Yeah. We go out under the big dark sky and watch the stars. And
lovely.
It's a wonderful way to end the day.
Yeah.
Piece of advice you'd give to your younger self?
Be patient. I got to where I am doing the stuff I'm doing only through a super windy, circuitous path. And I'm really glad I did it that way. Really glad I did it that way.
Me too. Me too. I think we're all glad. Thank you. Yeah. What's the best way for people to follow you and to support what you're doing?
You can find everything at jessicalahey.com. You can find me over at Twitter at @jessleahy. At jessicalahey.com, if you sign up for my email newsletter, you'll get all kinds of extra stuff videos, book discussion guides for Gift of Failure, and all the updates on where I'm speaking and when the new book comes out and the book tour and all that kind of fun stuff.
Great. Thank you. I will link to that in the show notes. Thank you so much for taking the time today. I am so grateful.
Can I say one last thing to you?
Yes.
I'm just so proud of you. I'm just so proud of you. It's likewise. Been such a privilege to watch you become the incredible woman that you've become.
Well, thank you so much. And you too. And I hope to follow in your footsteps and to write a book someday and to write more, because
absolutely,
your writing is such a gift to the world. And so I'm so excited to share it with more people and hopefully, yeah, learn from these lessons, these great lessons you have.
All right, sweet. So you can do it. I know you can.
Thank you so much.
All right. Love you. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
I am resilient, I trust the movement, I negate the chaos, uplift the negative, I'll show up at the table again and again and again, I'll close my mouth and learn to listen.
Special thanks goes to Avery Sandak for all the time he spent editing the audio on today's episode. To Rising Appalachia for generously providing the music for the opening and closing tracks. And to my partner, Rob Lee, for being extra quiet in the house where I'm recording. If you learned something from today's episode, share it with a friend. Until next time.